pre-analytical phase challenges account for the majority of variability in the analytical workflow. With the potential to impact biomarker test results, patient safety, and increase the cost burden for laboratories, it's important to highlight where pre-analytical challenges can have an impact and also how to address them. Listen or watch to find out more. This is the final podcast episode in a three-part series on pre-analytical phase challenges in biomarker testing. In this episode, we focus specifically on ovarian cancer. This podcast is an initiative of Core2Ed and supported by an independent educational grant from AstraZeneca and Amoy Diagnostics. Core2Ed is honored to introduce to you the oncology brothers, Drs. Rahul and Rohit Gosain, moderators of today's discussion, and Dr. Caterina Marchio, pathologist and associate professor at the Candiolo Cancer Institute, and Dr. Martina Murphy, oncologist and associate professor at the University of Florida.
Hello, everyone. I am Rahul Gosain.
And I'm Rohit Gosain.
And we are the oncology brothers. As a general medical oncologist here in the US, we have to keep up with all that is happening around us in hematologic and solid malignancies. With close to 20,000 new diagnoses here in the US and more than 300,000 new cases worldwide each year, ovarian cancer is something that should be on our radar. To do better for our patients, it is important for us to appreciate all the pre-analytical phase challenges and biomarker testing in ovarian cancer. To cover this topic today, we're joined by Dr. Martina Murphy, a medical oncologist, associate professor of medicine, and a program director for the fellowship training program at the University of Florida, and Dr. Caterina Marchio, a pathologist and an associate professor at the Candiolo Cancer Institute in Italy. Martina and Caterina, welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, absolutely. It's a great pleasure for us to be here with you today.
Martina and Caterina, thank you so much for again joining us. Caterina, as a medical oncologist, before we even get a chance to discuss treatment options with our patients, there is quite a bit happening behind the scenes to make the right diagnosis. Accurate biomarker identification is paramount as it affects our treatment decisions. However, right from tissue collection from biopsy and to biomarker analysis, this is quite a challenging process, which can in fact impact diagnosis as well as treatment decisions, as one relies on germline and somatic mutation, some aspect of it, for treatment decisions. Before we go any further, Caterina, can you please clarify the difference between germline and somatic mutations here?
Yes, absolutely right. I think it's a great way to start this discussion. As a matter of fact, we are dealing every day with a diagnostic on either a germline or a somatic mutation in two main genes that are BRCA1 and BRCA2. So it's good to start by, you know, definitions. When we have a germline mutation, it means that we have this mutation, this DNA alteration that has actually affected the germ cells, the reproductive cells. So this alteration is present in any cell of our body. And the fact that we have this alteration at birth, basically, because it's a mutation that is inherited from our parents, unfortunately give us the chance to develop more frequently an ovarian cancer, as well as a breast carcinoma as well. On the other way, if you have a somatic mutation, this means that the DNA alteration has actually affected a cell after our birth, let's say, because of environmental issues, because other type of exposure to other type of toxic agents. And in the end, the mutation is going to be restricted only to the tumor cells. But at the end of the day, we are both interested in germline and somatic mutation affecting BRCA1 and BRCA2, because regardless of the origin of this mutation, we know that if we have a mutation in this specific ovarian cancer patient, then we have a therapeutic option that Martina will tell us more about later on, I guess.
Thanks so much, Caterina. Martina, anything that you would like to add that is from a clinical standpoint, do these mutations truly have any implications for our patients from treatment standpoint?
That's a fabulous question. And first of all, thank you so much for including me in this conversation. So as Katarina was starting to talk about, analysis of these tumor-specific biomarkers is really critical when it comes to informing us regarding potential targeted therapies for our patients with ovarian cancer. And so making sure that we're, one, testing the right things, we're testing them accurately, and we're ensuring accessibility for all of our patients is really critically important. So to get to your question, I want to talk just real quickly about sort of the key biomarkers of clinical relevance as it currently stands. Certainly science is changing every day, but as it currently stands, in ovarian cancer, of course, we have BRCA1 and BRCA2, like Katarina mentioned. So germline testing for BRCA is really important in ovarian cancer. Also somatic testing, but germline in particular, because it informs not only treatment decisions for our patients, but it also informs potential risk-reducing strategies for patients themselves, but also their families. So germline testing for BRCA1 and 2, also somatic testing. It's also become clear that there are other gene variants that are BRCA-like and that result in homologous recombination deficiency, or HRD, that are important to know about. So sort of big picture, BRCA testing and HRD status are both really important when it comes to determining eligibility for and magnitude of benefit from PARP inhibition following platinum-based chemotherapy. Another really important and sort of newer biomarker is the folate receptor alpha. And folate receptor alpha is something that's present in about 35 to 40% of ovarian cancers. And when it's present, we do have a therapeutic target. So mirvetuximab soravtansine was approved last year. It is an antibody drug conjugate that targets folate receptor alpha. And it is a treatment option for women who have platinum resistant ovarian cancer whose tumors express folate receptor alpha. And then finally, the other thing, immunotherapy is not a big player in ovarian cancer to date, but knowing MMR status is important in this patient population, especially people who develop recurrent platinum-resistant disease. So if someone is deficient in mismatch repair, certainly immunotherapy is an option.
Martina, Katarina, thank you so much for covering that. Very recently, we've also seen a broader guidelines from ASCO when it comes to testing for these patients, more so from the breast cancer side of things. But it is so important for us to appreciate that BRCA1, BRCA2, looking for these germline mutation is so important. And then again, Martina, you've mentioned the folate receptor alpha, which is a very good example of a somatic mutation that we can go after. So here, multidisciplinary approach is so important. It is important in all cancers, but when it comes to ovarian cancer, even if it's advanced disease, surgery can play a big role here in getting us bigger tissue sample or for debulking. Katarina, coming back again to the biopsy, is initial FNA biopsy tissue enough? Or do you have to go back for more testing on surgical specimen after the patient has undergone surgery?
Well, let's say that for pathologists, the more the merrier, I would say. So we are always asking for more, our radiologists, our surgeons. So we are very happy to work with surgeons in this context because it gives us the opportunity to have samples that are more cellular. They are more abundant in tumor cells. So when we work with the surgical biopsy, we are definitely much happier. Nevertheless, I would say that sometimes fine needle aspiration or paracentesis, so liquid fluids, can also be a source of tumor cells. In the end, we are interested in tumor cell when we do an NGS testing. So even, you know, pure cells that come from bodily fluids could be an option, especially when we have ascites. This could be a source of tumor cell that can be also very abundant in terms of cellularity. Sometimes we may also have some small biopsy taken via percutaneous way. So this is also a kind of option. We try to do our best from the tissue that we have available, also based on the fact that we don't want to distress the patient too much. So it's also a matter of a balance between what it can be done for that patient and what we can obtain out of it. So, but yes, I would say that in this context, if we have a very good amount of tissue, it's gonna, let's say, guarantee that the workflow for the tissue specimen is going to be more successful compared to other options. And we want to, of course, when we start profiling, for instance, with an NGS test, it's going to be a long journey. Sometimes it takes weeks. So We don't want to, you know, to fail at the very end because of an issue related to tumor cellularity. So, of course, pathologists know that they have to double check that very seriously. They have to be sure that when we go, you know, when we kick off with an NGS testing, it is the right specimen, it is adequate, there is good tumor cellularity, and it's also of good quality, because a test may fail not just because we don't have enough cells. We may have a lot of cells, but not very, very well preserved. So preservation of tissue sample in this context is very important.
Katrina, can you talk a little more about some key challenges that you might run into tissue collection, processing of the ovarian cancer tissue, and something for us to learn from that?
We talked a bit about type of samples, but when you get the samples, you also need to manage it and to handle it. So I think you need to liaise a little bit with either the radiological suite or the surgical theaters, because as pathologists, we get the samples from these two main, let's say, collectors. So it's always best to have a very good relationship with them so that you can organize a very smooth workflow for sample transportation, for instance. Because we need to get the sample as quickly as possible so that we can ascertain whether it is fresh or not. Because if it's fresh, we need to immediately fix it. So, and fixation is paramount in this context. So fixation is made with formalin. And formalin fixation is guaranteed at best if we use 10% neutral buffer formalin. That is the, you know, the fixative that is suggested and highly recommended by all guidelines from different type of biomarkers that we assess in pathology for our cancer patients, not only ovarian cancer patients. We need to double check whether we ensure that the fixation is properly done. So technically, you would say that the interval that is recommended is between 6 hours and not more than 72 hours. So for small specimen, at least 6 hours, then you can double check your specimen. For larger specimen where you do the sampling, then you should not go beyond 72 hours. So why it's so important to have rules or at least recommendation in this context? Because we know that formalin is needed to fix the sample, but on the other side, it's also going to affect our nucleic acids. And, you know, today we are talking a lot about sequencing, NGS testing. You sequence DNA. So DNA is going to be fragmented by your formalin fixation, and you can also have alteration in the basis of the DNA. So you need to be sure that the length of fixation is proper and is not too much overfixed or too less fixed. So overfixation and underfixation can represent a problem.
And then Martina, here, another tool for our disposal is liquid biopsy. Where do you see this getting fit in with the ovarian cancer, because we tend to rely on this quite a bit on our other tumor samples, particularly for lung cancer, GI cancers?
Yeah, I'll tell you that this is a question that I get asked more and more in my own clinic just by my patients, because certainly patients would love to, you know, first and foremost, not have to undergo a biopsy, if you know, an invasive biopsy, if at all possible. And certainly when it comes to surveillance of ovarian cancer, you know, more tools that are disposable would be better. As of right now, liquid biopsy has not proven to be a great reliable source of information for ovarian cancer. My hope is that that will change as we sort of perfect our techniques and, again, really better understand what it is we actually need to be looking for in liquid biopsy. I think, and Katarina, weigh in on this, please. I think part of the issue with liquid biopsy in ovarian cancer is that ovarian cancer spreads a little bit differently than some of the other tumors in which liquid biopsy is beneficial. It certainly can and does spread hematogenously, but it also spreads just by sort of sloughing of cancer cells into the peritoneal cavity. So it makes liquid biopsy a little bit less specific, if you will, in ovarian cancer. And so far, it's not something that we use on a regular basis outside the context of a study or a clinical trial.
When you talk about tumor sloughing, I just want to add that, though I'll be opening a new can of worms when I bring this topic. Any update from circulating tumor DNA aspect of it, especially when there are tumor sloughing present, it'll be rather easier to hopefully pick that up if there is any tumor presence or rather absence.
So that's a reason why it would make sense that this would be something that we could do. I think we're just still trying to perfect the technique and, again, exactly what it is that we're looking for and how that fits into the current treatment and surveillance algorithms. More to come, I suspect. And certainly it's a thing that we would all love to have available rather than repeat biopsies and things of that nature.
And Katrina, as we're on this topic of solid or liquid biopsy, any regional or global differences that you're aware of when it comes to pre-analytical challenges or how these solid or liquid biopsies are processed?
Well, I would leave a little bit aside, as Martina was saying, the liquid biopsy, because right now the liquid biopsy, as we mean in other type of oncological malignant, let's say, areas, it's not actually common practice. So let's focus more on tissue sample. This could be histological sample, but they could be also in the form of a cytological sample, as I was mentioning before. So the peritoneal spread, the ascites can be collected. So we can also have cytological specimen to analyze. I would say that depending on the center and depending also the habit of the different surgeons and radiologists to approach this type of disease, there might be a different type of source of the tissue sample. So either a surgical biopsy or a biopsy that is taken from the radiologist, or a peritoneal spread that is collected via paracentesis. But probably if there are any differences that are major in this context, they might be on the technology and on the type of, the type of comprehensive testing that can be done for our patients. So I would say that is a must that we have to sequence BRCA1 and BRCA2. That's a must. So we need to have those two. Those two guys need to be in our report. There's no possibility to wait for, something else from germline and somatic. I would say, that's the point that we need to say that actually the testing now is approached in a somatic way. So even though we are looking for both germline and somatic mutations, so ideally you can also approach the disease only, starting from the germline analysis. Right now, given that the tissue actually is the one that is in our hands. And actually the tumor cells can have either a somatic mutation or a germline mutation, but also if you are in a context of a germline alteration, the tumor could have the BRCA mutation. So that's why now we approach directly from the tissue, because the tissue can detect, by analyzing the tissue, we can detect both germline and somatic mutation. So our point here is not to distinguish at the very beginning whether the mutation is somatic or germline. Our first point is to detect whether there is a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation, okay? Once we detect a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation, then we interrogate, the patient and the clinical history and the germline to see whether the mutation is somatic or germline. But first, we detect whether there is a mutation. Second, we deepen the analysis and we look whether this is a germline or a somatic mutation. Because at this point, we have the possibility to treat the patient, and that's what the patient needs first, okay? Then, once we have the answer related to either a germline somatic mutation, if we detect that the mutation is germline, then we approach also the relatives. So we do the cascade testing, we do all the other, testing that is needed for the family and for the patient. Once we have BRCA1 and BRCA2, we are already, very far from in our journey. It's for Martina, it's good to have this information. What we can do in some areas, in some institution, it's something more than BRCA1 and BRCA2. So by using a comprehensive genomic approach that is doable in some institution, we may analyze more than BRCA1 and BRCA2. So we may do a panel testing. So we can go up from 50 to 500 genes. And so that's why we can detect additional alterations that could be relevant for the patient, maybe not right now, maybe in the future for the second line, third line of therapy. So I would say that the differences may be in the amount of testing that we do.
Now, bringing that information to our clinical space, that is, we have the BRCA mutation, somatic or germline, and we know and we have the evidence of utilizing PARP inhibitor in the space. Martina, any evidence for extending this indication to homologous recombination deficiency here?
Yeah, so I think it can get tricky, right? Because we have all of this information that we want to get, and how do we sequence and time it? So I would say at the bare minimum, I'm going to slowly answer your question, but I promise I will answer it. at the bare minimum, the guidelines, all of the national societies that sort of touch ovarian cancer, so ASCO, SGO, IGCS, all of the guidelines say that molecular testing in ovarian cancer needs to include, at the bare minimum, germline BRCA testing. Now, as Katarina said, We're also interested in somatic BRCA, and many of us will also get HRD testing for the reasons that we talked about before. And we used to sequence this in clinical practice. We used to do germline BRCA first, and then if that was negative, then, you know, reflex to do somatic and HRD testing on the tumor itself. From a practical perspective, that's really not always realistic, and it can be very logistically difficult, as you guys know, to keep track of which patients have had which testing and what order. And so I think many of us in clinical practice will send, at the time of diagnosis, will send germline panel testing, as well as comprehensive genomic profiling using NGS, again, at the time of diagnosis, recognizing that we're probably not going to do anything with the NGS information right now, but we really want to have as much information as we possibly can moving forward with a patient. Now, one thing I will say just from the clinical perspective is it is if you're doing that, and this is what I do in my clinical practice, it's important that you know what things are included on your NGS panel, because not every company includes, for example, the folate receptor alpha. I think they all include HRD at this point, but that wasn't always the case. So just being aware as a clinician of what is actually included on the panel that you're sending, I guess even more importantly, what's not included and what do you need to make sure that you're searching for?
Martina, thank you for covering that. Is folate receptor alpha a resistant mutation, or can we pick that up upfront? Because what I'm trying to understand, if we see progressive disease, is there any role in repeating NGS at the time of progression?
So folate receptor alpha is one of those things that you're either positive for or not. So you can do that testing at the outset. Now, that's a little bit of a different question than whether or not people need to have repeat NGS testing. And I'm truly not hedging. I don't think that there's one right answer to this. In my view, it really depends on the clinical context, right? So certainly not every patient who has had NGS at diagnosis needs to have it repeated, you know, at the time or, you know, later down the line. I think some of that depends on, one, whether or not they had NGS testing to begin with, right? How long it's been since their diagnosis. And maybe Katarina can speak a little bit to that. And then the other context in which I might repeat NGS testing, again, if it's a patient who hasn't had it in a long time, and on that initial testing didn't really have any therapeutic targets present for potential clinical trial enrollment. And now maybe it's been some time, they have developed platinum resistant disease, and they're not a candidate for mirvetuximab. I'd be particularly interested in that patient, potentially repeating NGS to see if they have any targetable or actionable mutations just as is, and whether or not it opens up potential clinical trial opportunities for them at that time. But again, not one right answer here.
Katarina, from your standpoint, especially from the progression standpoint, like, does that make any difference on getting the tissue sample?
Well, as Martina was saying, and I totally agree with her, I think there is not right answer at the moment. We still have not much data on that. So we need to get a little bit more. Also, it depends on the clinical history, I would say. So also, if you have unexpected clinical course for your patient, it's always wise to, you know, to retest if you have the possibility to collect again tissue. But you also need to deal with the possibility to get other tissue, whether a tissue is accessible. So I would say that right now, what I see most is a very good comprehensive genomic profiling done at time of diagnosis when you have a good amount of tissue and you need to, let's say, to have all the details to start treatment, and you keep all the additional information for later on, I would say. Then if there's something that is, of course, coming out that is more interesting as a biomarker, as a target, and it's also something I would say that is not tested by NGS, because we are talking a lot about NGS because we are focusing on mutation right now. But we need to remember the pathology is multimodal. So if, as Martina was saying, we expect something from, immunotherapy, and we find out that the evaluation of expression of protein is important, is relevant, that's something that needs to be done by another technique. So we need to implement, integrate according to the new evidence. Right now, I would say that I see a very good immunohistochemical profiling done at the very beginning because we need to define the histological type. We didn't mention that, but we are not doing this type of testing in any histological type of cancer or ovarian tumor. There's a plethora of histological types, so we are focusing on high-grade zero and poorly differentiated carcinoma, on which you cannot exclude a high-grade zero carcinoma for this type of testing. So first, you need to label the tumor. Then you go to NGS to this type of testing when it's needed. If you can do a comprehensive genomic profile, you also gather more information that can be useful later on. And then you stay updated, as Martina was saying, and you integrate when needed.
Thanks for covering that, Katrina and Martina. Rahul, talking about the NGS, any particular differences have you noticed in clinical practice in community centers? And if you were to compare this to academics, especially personally, when we get these reports out in community, I feel very overwhelmed. And that has been the consensus throughout the community aspect of it. And initially, that's why people were rather hesitant even ordering these reports.
Yeah, a few things here, Katrina, you brought up. The first step is let's figure out what histology we're dealing with. And then NGS ends up being the secondary thing. Both are important, but again, establishing the main diagnoses here and then moving on to what's another tool is, I want to emphasize that. Rohit, NGS platforms, because we're using this for ovarian cancer, lung cancer, prostate cancer, at least in my practice, we partner up with third parties to do comprehensive testings. Because in the community, in-house testing is more spot testing. Martina mentioned this as well. Logistically, practically, it ends up being tough to go back and repeat for one more test or look for resistant mutation or this or that. So upfront, at least in my practice, I rely with this comprehensive testing panel. And then talking about these reports being cumbersome and dissecting all the data on these reports can be very overwhelming.
And that's such a good point too, because I mean, patients also get these reports. And, you know, I think it's a wonderful thing with the technology that we have that, you know, patients are getting more access to their medical information. I think generally speaking, that's a fabulous thing. It is important though, that, you know, these reports, they can be overwhelming and cumbersome to us as clinicians. And so then patients get a hold of these and it's, you know, I see it all the time. What does this mean? And, you know, so it can be really challenging and we have to spend a lot of time in our visits, rightly so, sort of educating our patients and their families and caregivers about what do all of these tests mean, practically speaking. So just an important point I wanted to make.
Right. And I couldn't agree more, Martina, especially when we, as you mentioned, being in clinical setting, it is overwhelming for us thinking about that patient perspective. It's certainly very overwhelming to begin with. So important, comprehensive testing, at least here in USA, is a better approach, not only for ovarian cancer, but for all or most of our patients, especially when you talk about personalized medicine for so many bucket approvals. As you're nearing the end, Katrina, any last few words for our listeners on this particular topic?
Well, what I always say when we talk about comprehensive genomic profiling and NGS testing, depending also on the size of the panel that you're using, so the amount of information that we were discussing that we get out of it, the more you look at, the higher complexity you get, and you need to handle this complexity. So it's always a teamwork. It's good that today, for instance, there's an oncologist, there's a pathologist. So I think these are two key figure in our multidisciplinary meeting that need to be present, but also the geneticists, a bioinformatician if needed. And so I think that it's good in this precise moment to share, to discuss the interpretation of these results, also because then it gets better when we talk to our patients. And I guess that Martina knows that very, very well. So we need to be communicative in the end and do the right job in terms of delivering the right information at the right time in order to make the patient aware of their disease and the options and handle these complexities. So I would say let's team up always, especially in this very complex scenario.
Couldn't agree more, especially when you talk about multidisciplinary approach, and all this has implications of prognosis, treatment decisions for the patients and their families tied up with this. Martina, any last thoughts on what we have covered or what we might have missed here?
Well, I'll just echo what Katarina said. I think one of the reasons why so many of us went into oncology, it has to do with the fact that it is a multidisciplinary field, and that is just growing more and more important as, again, the science grows and the amount of knowledge that we're responsible for grows. I think the key takeaway point that I want to make is just that, you know, obviously it's very important for us to understand what the key biomarkers are in ovarian cancer and how they're clinically relevant. And I think it's really important that we work to, and this is at the level of a clinician, but also sort of a healthcare system level. I think it's very important that we work to ensure equitable access to all of this specialized testing to make sure that we're really across the board, no matter where a patient comes from, that they're getting high quality care for all cancer types, but certainly in the context of ovarian cancer.
Katarina and Martina, thank you so much for covering this critical topic of pre-analytical phase challenges and biomarker testing and its implications in our day-to-day practice, in particularly ovarian cancers. For our listeners, please make sure to check out our prostate cancer and lung cancer discussion in this space. We are the Oncology Brothers.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast on pre-analytical phase challenges and biomarker selection in ovarian cancer. If you like this episode, then please look for the other episodes in this series on the Oncology Medical Conversation podcast under the account of CORE2AD Medical Education, where we discuss pre-analytical phase challenges and biomarker testing for lung and prostate cancer. If you're interested in finding out more about precision oncology, then please visit CORE2AD.com and select Oncology. If you liked this podcast, then don't forget to rate this episode or inform your colleagues about it. Thank you for listening and see you next time. This podcast is an initiative of CORE2AD and developed by Precision Oncology Connect, a group of international experts working in the field of oncology. The views expressed are the personal opinions of the experts. They do not necessarily represent the view of the experts' organizations or the rest of the Precision Oncology Connect group. For expert disclosures on any conflict of interest, please visit the CORE2AD website.